From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The political outrage continued this week after President Trump's meeting with Vladimir Putin a week ago. It now includes calls for President Trump to be removed from office on the grounds of treason, and in one case, an allegedly leftist website contained an article calling for a military coup to remove Trump and, after trial, hang him. But we open our discussion with Professor Tony Montero with reference to a much saner conversation that he had with BlackAgendaReport.com's Glenn Ford last week.
Well, you know, that interview, which I think got a lot of circulation on social media and perhaps other places because of the headline where I asserted that Trump was the most pro-peace president since John F. Kennedy.
Right.
And I conditioned it, with the observation that no American presidency in the last 70 years or a little more has been pro-peace, because each of them in one or another way has had to bow to the state and to the requirements of American hegemony or the Pax Americana, the American Empire. Yeah. But once you peel away all of the rhetoric of the mainstream media and the punditry, and even a lot of Trump's tweeting and histrionics, I think, what you see is a certain logic that goes against the direction of defending and consolidating American hegemony, even if doing it under new conditions of the rise of China and the rise of Asia and the relative decline of American power. So on the one side, you get Hillary, who wanted to make certain minor reforms while at the same time pursuing the project of war and imperialist advance. And you had Trump, who even during the campaign said the very opposite. He was calling for imperial retreat,
right,
literally saying that we had to prepare ourselves for an era of peaceful coexistence with China and Russia and economic competition.
Right.
And whether one agrees with how he pursues the economic competition, that is through tariffs and what they're calling a trade war, is one thing. However, when he says he is in favor of doing all of this through peaceful means and detente and peaceful coexistence, that is something that we have to take seriously. And the problem is that the left, which is really, for the most part, social democratic and liberal left, with on its fringe the anarchists, Trotskyists, ultra-leftists, but all a part of a single cloth of the anti-Trump movement, wrongly called the resistance, are missing it all and do not understand the historic moment that we live in.
You know, it seems to me that no matter what the avowed political orientation of the commentator today, looking at what happens with Trump, the present company accepted, but the ideological slice or micro slice, given the way the left is so parceled up, that regardless of how they approach the problem, at the end of the day, in a world where there, the U.S. is at war in 7 or 8 or 10, depending on which calculus you used, different places, where millions of people are literally, a meal away from dying in places like Yemen and DR Congo and elsewhere, where NATO and the U.S. allies in Asia, essentially the U.S. military, is up against the borders of Russia and China and drilling like mad for the last 4 years now. No matter what the supposed theoretical approach of the commentator is, none of them, for some reason, are able to look at Trump saying, let's back off of this and re-engage the world in a peaceful fashion instead of going to war with Russia and China. No one seems to be able to say, yes, let's declare support for that position and figure out how to actualize it. You have the President of the United States, for the first time in my lifetime, because your article says essentially Trump is the most pro-peace president we've had since JFK, and of course the JFK when he was attacking the CIA back in his day, like Trump is doing now, could have said, "Hey, I need the CIA like I need another hole in my head." That no one, not one. Not the PSL or International Action or any anarchist or RCP. Or nobody seems to be able to say, we have to assume that this guy is telling the truth regardless of his intent and force his hand with our support. Nobody's saying that, which is normally how you engage in politics.
No. Well, one thing you've mentioned the so-called revolutionary left, and I say so-called because that's yet to be shown that they're revolutionary, but they have, for the most part, never been involved in politics in the Leninist sense of politics or the revolutionary sense of politics. They long ago abandoned any attempt at mobilizing and going among the masses to talk about what the issues are. And in the first place, I would say, and this is the segment of the population that they have written off, which is probably among the most politically mobilized and active parts of the population, it's that group of people who, irregardless of party identification, put Trump in office. And a big part of that group is the formerly industrial proletariat. And I always go back to Pennsylvania. Trump could not have won Pennsylvania, which no Republican had done in over 30 years, had those small, formerly industrial steel towns in western Pennsylvania and other manufacturing towns in central Pennsylvania and the unemployed and poor of Philadelphia. If that group had not either voted for Trump or refused to vote at all, which meant voting for Hillary Clinton, if that had not happened, Trump could not have won Pennsylvania. To me, that is the group that the radicals and so-called revolutionaries have to focus upon, not as they are doing, the petty bourgeoisie who are good at turning out for rallies but cannot sustain anything, especially in the battle of ideas and the battle of political organization. I say all that to say that that group that voted Trump into office have pretty much remained consistent in their demand that which he articulated, that we don't want war with Russia, that intervention and regime change has gotten us into a situation of endless war, and they didn't want that anymore, that they wanted some addressing of this inequality that flows out of this neoliberal globalization and the World Trade Organization and these global trade agreements and treaties like the Trans-Pacific Partnership. They wanted done with that. They wanted a renegotiation of NAFTA. I mean, they wanted jobs and peace. That's what they were saying.
That's right.
And for the so-called left, now here I'm using it in the broad sense, both the ultra-left and the social democratic and liberal left have joined hands really with the deep state in a united front against Trump and literally are calling for either his impeachment or his removal from office, as one commentator said, by any means necessary. This is an abandonment of the working class of all colors and of the poor who have nothing to do with their resistance. So I stand by what I said in the interview with Glenn Ford. Indeed, he is the most peace candidate. In fact, he might go beyond JFK. And it's in both the positive sense of negotiations and summitry with Kim Jong-un, with Vladimir Putin, and possibly in the future with Xi Jinping, but in the negative sense of opposition to the expansion of NATO, of calling into question NATO's existence. What does it exist for? And the other thing is that his example is encouraging similar movements throughout Europe. We are literally looking at a collapse of the old European order. That is the order that emerges after World War II based upon American power and European acquiescence in and support for American power. This is now in crisis. Even Henry Kissinger admitted that Trump is one of those figures who comes along occasionally in history who represent the end of an era and the beginning, perhaps, of something new.
You know, it's, I think, timely to mention the, I guess, the fact that the post-World War II order, really, it's... utility has been largely spent.
Yeah.
We saw that being acknowledged in Europe 30 years ago now, with the reunification of Germany, the dissolution of the Bloc. That was the Bloc that the Soviet Union had organized in mm-hmm. response to NATO. Mm-hmm. The rhetoric of the time, which made it appear that what was happening on the east side of the division line in Europe was also happening on the west side, that there had been an acknowledgement that Bloc politics were obsolete and that now we're all going to be pals. And so go ahead and deconstruct your defensive apparatus, and we will deconstruct our offensive apparatus. But what ended up happening was they just put the offensive apparatus on rail cars and rolled it up to Russia's border and started building it up on site.
Right.
You had, though, no similar movements in Asia, with the exception, a big exception, of the change in relations with China, which contained within it the contradictions of things like Tiananmen Square, with an attempted color revolution in China. But now it seems that Trump's election In the context of the rising multipolarity and on the international scene, either was in response to, or in any event, is related to further maturing of the international situation and sort of like a return to or construction of a new normalcy. And looking at Korea, that's a perfect example of that, because the situation there is, again, a legacy of World War II, and really even earlier, but that division there is a legacy of bloc politics with blocs that don't really exist anymore.
Right, or unnecessary, yeah. I mean, you know, it's one of those moments where the ruling classes cannot rule in the old way, and the people are not going to be ruled in the right. same old ways.
Right.
And that is reflected differently in different parts of the country. Again, and we've talked about this so much, you and I, Don, over the last few years, couple few years, and that is this crisis of legitimacy. And that's a nice word usually used in bourgeois political science for what Lenin said, a crisis of that could lead to a radical change. That is where the people are not going to be ruled in the ways they have been ruled.
Right.
And they are rejecting the old political parties, the old politicians, the media, are looking for new forms of political organization, and they're really calling for a new way of governance. And I think inherent in this, in spite of all of the discrediting of the ordinary working person and the poor, inherent in this is a call for greater democracy, a people's democracy. And Trump manifested that, reflected that in the 2016 election. His victory was a rejection not just of Hillary Clinton, of course of her, and the corporate Democrats, but it was a rejection of the corporate Republicans. Let's not forget, he defeated 17 Republicans.
That's right.
In the primary. We cannot overlook that. And he defeated all of them soundly. I mean, this is unprecedented.
That's right.
And he literally called for what happened in the most recent Italian election. You know, the Northern League and the Five Star Movement uniting to form a government. He reached out to Bernie Sanders. It was Bernie Sanders who rejected Trump. And I think Sanders' rejection of Trump had a lot to do with Sanders' commitments to the old order of American hegemony, American militarism, and American imperialism abroad while talking about social reforms at home. And if you think about it, Sanders has not yet taken a position either on the military budget or on détente and peaceful coexistence with Russia, North Korea, China, and other countries. So it was Sanders who ran back to the corporate Democrats who failed the people and his voters in 2016. And I think going forward, and I'm going to make a prediction, the Democrats will not take back the House in 2018. And if Trump survives, he will be reelected in 2020. And he will do what he said he would do. If you remember, in 2016, he said that if he has two terms as president, he will turn the Republican Party into a workers' party. Or I would interpret that to mean a party that better reflects the interests of working people, which both the Republicans and Democrats have had abandoned decades ago,
decades,
if they ever were committed to that.
That's right. Agreed. It's tough to reach into your hat and pull out the day that they were representing them. You have to go back to like Teddy to Franklin Roosevelt. You know, on that question, you know, you've got Sanders, for example, calling Trump a traitor now for meeting with Putin. You know, no agreements were signed with Putin. We have no idea what the conversation behind closed doors was, but we also have no idea what the conversation behind closed doors was between Obama and Putin, the Bush and Putin, Clinton and what's his name after last call at the bar?
Yeltsin.
You know, Reagan and or Bush and Gorbachev or whoever earlier. You know, this is Gerald Ford meeting with Brezhnev behind closed doors in Helsinki. This is the way that these things are done, and yet the big concern is this: when you have Sanders on the one hand being heralded by the media and in his own carefully chosen words, even by himself as a socialist, on the one hand, without a vigorous critique of American imperialism on the other, I'm wondering exactly what kind of socialism you have where the economy that's going to be democratically controlled and owned by the working class can be fueled by labor and materials stolen from other working people at gunpoint around the world.
Right. That's right. And that's the contradiction of social democracy and has been for 150 years. I mean, let's be real. You would not have had the need for Leninism or Bolshevism had social democracy evolved into a revolutionary position. It retreated from that, especially during World War I, where the social democrats united with their bourgeois governments and went to war with their fellow working classes in countries that were deemed the enemies, you know? So, listen, I mean, you know, when you look at Sanders, he is a spent force. Now, you know, he's trying to make himself look younger by, grabbing onto Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. But her victory, of course, you know, we celebrate, but in a very limited way. Because her program, she doesn't have a real program to address the multiple crises and problems of the working class, nor does she have any sense of the world crisis and how to address these problems. I think that a sophisticated politician at this time would do as we have discussed over these many, many months, criticize Trump on the issues he needs to be criticized, and sharply, especially on the economy, on the environment, but then support him on the question of peace and imperial retreat. And I guess the other thing is that all of the most important questions, ironically, are not driven by domestic concerns, but the most important questions are driven by the international situation and how the United States ruling class will manage its retreat as it must do. Trump is just years ahead of most of the ruling class. And a lot of people say, well, he represents one part of the ruling class. Well, maybe that's true. But he is a singular figure in history who I think represents more the broad masses who have suffered under the World Trade Organization, under trade agreements like the Trans-Pacific Partnership and NAFTA, who have suffered in multiple ways by these permanent wars in the Middle East, and who have in many ways begun to say they don't want to study war no more, which is another way of saying They don't want to be the instruments of imperial hegemony, that the United States must reposition itself in the world. Now, you know, saying that, a lot of people say, well, that's not what the polling data shows. Well, the polling data is incapable of measuring the nuances and even contradictions among and within the broad masses of people. But when you look at what collective behavior, collective political behavior tends to say about major issues of our time. And I'm not talking about abortion.
I'm not even talking
about some of these other legal questions. I'm talking about the great issues of our time, war and peace, and the possibility of imperial retreat, which then makes a lot of other things possible for the domestic economy and for the social needs of the masses of working people, and I include among them the working middle class, the professional classes, and so on.
I mean, you can include among some of those questions the life of every species on the planet, because the question of war and peace with Russia and China in this particular age is a question of the survival or non-survival of human species and most others that are susceptible to death by radioactivity.
You're absolutely right. You know, so war and peace is the major question of environment.
That's right. It is a major question. It's a major question of the day. We're getting close to time. We got about 3 minutes left. One of the things I wanted to make sure that we cover is essentially the response that comes from people on the left when you say, why are we not organizing that which calls itself the anti-war movement to support Trump's efforts in Helsinki to defend him against impeachment for treason on those points, and also to try to lead from behind. In other words, to raise more demands and say, not only do Helsinki, but start working on nuclear disarmament and start making peace for real in Syria and Ukraine and blah, blah, blah. When we're not doing that, instead, the reaction is that the U.S. and Russia are equivalent. They are both evil capitalist powers, that Trump is an equivalent to Clinton, in essence, and that there is no space because the bad guys have control of the levers of power here no matter what. How do we how do we address that?
Well, first of all, you know, we have to demand a certain amount of political realism. Trump is not the most evil president that the United States has ever had, or certainly in the last 70, 75 years. And that's the way he's being portrayed, as a corrupt oligarch driven by venality and selfishness and racism. You know, in fact, I think that as president, on questions of war and peace, he is more advanced than Obama, certainly than Bush, by rejecting the Clinton call for a no-fly zone over Syria. He was rejecting a Libyan solution to the Syrian question. That is very, very important. By not treating Vladimir Putin and the government of Russia as a dictatorship and as an equal evil to himself, as he is, as Putin is defined, he makes a tremendous contribution to the struggle for peace. For meeting with Kim Jong-un, the leader of North Korea, and treating him as an equal, not as a pariah. He makes a profound contribution to the atmosphere of the fight for peace. I mean, these people whose main energy is being devoted to a protest against Trump's alleged military parade. Well, I'm not for the military parade. but I'm not for your demonstration either. Right. Because that's all you're going to do is a demonstration, and hopefully somebody will capture you in the mass media.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.